the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 438 for Wednesday, the 25th of February, 2015. My name is Harry Lloyd, and I'm joined by Len Padilla over in maybe not so sunny Spain. How's it going, Len?
It's going okay, Harry. Yeah, you're right. It's not so sunny. Like I said earlier, it's raining. Rivers are overflowing, but no locusts yet, so I don't think it's the apocalypse.
Well, at least don't have to worry about that one, eh?
Not yet.
So you've been out doing a bit of riding, judging by your Twitter. How'd that go?
Yeah, that was tons of fun. I got a new bike, so I was off testing it out. Well, you know, testing it out. Not like I wasn't going to buy it if I didn't like it, because I've already ridden it. But that was lots of fun. Yeah, so I was 3 days at Valencia, which I'd never been to, actually. So it was fun to ride somewhere new. Get a perspective on, you know, it's funny, the GP riders call it a go-kart track.
Yeah.
And I kind of have to agree, you know, I was on a big bike, so there's not a lot of chance to really let it run. You're in second gear almost, the entire track, but it was fun. You know, a bad track day is better than any day working, and it wasn't a bad track day. It was tons of fun. We had a really good time. And, you know, good to hang out with friends and see people I haven't seen in a while. So all very good.
Ah, well, as long as you had fun, that's all that matters, right? Winning's not important. It's just about having fun.
No winning at track days. Even if you're the fastest, there's no trophies.
That's true, I guess. Well, I guess we should say thank you to some donators. We had John Thalmitz. I think that's how you say your last name, John. Thank you for your donation. And thank you to Keelan Carroll for the subscription. Those do help out Motopod immensely. If you'd like to join either Keelan or John, you can go to the motopodcast.com website, and on the left-hand side there is a donate and or subscribe button. The subscription's obviously a once-a-month thing, and there's different levels for that. Or if you just want to donate a one-time fee, you can do that. We'll read out whatever message you say if you want us to read out anything. And yeah, just thanks again to those for donating and helping to keep the show chugging along, because it really does help. And also, we have some listener feedback, which we'll get into in a second. But if you'd like to send your thoughts, comments, ideas, criticisms, whatever, to us, go for motopod@motopodcast.com. Len is now on that email address after a bit. So you can now await one of his replies to your questions as well.
Yeah, I'll be sure to jump in there and let people know my 2 pennies, Eurocents, whatever worth.
So this email comes in from Jarrett Bean, who has conveniently broken this email up into very easy to answer sections. So I think we'll read through it, and then we'll answer each section as we go. So the first question is just a quick question. What are you guys looking forward to most in the 2015 season across the 3 classes of World Championship? So for me, personally, I'd say I'm kind of looking forward to Moto2 the most for once. I think that Alex Rins and Alex Marquez are going to be very interesting and very exciting to watch in Moto2, and I think it'll be interesting to see how Rabat does in comparison to them, and also how some older guys, or maybe not older guys, but guys who have been in the series a bit longer, like Johann Zarco, do, especially now that it's become the Calix Cup. What about you, Len?
Well, yeah, the things that I'm interested in are to see how Mika Kallio does.
Mm.
He's, you know, he was right up there last year. He's on a similar bike, but different team. So it'll be interesting to see if they can keep his good performance going. And the other thing, you know, there's been glimmers of hope from Lowe's on the speed up. So I'm interested to see if that carries over into the season. It'd be a shame if the category turns out to be completely the Calix Cup. I'd really like to see, you know, something else up there mixing it up.
Yeah, certainly. And it would actually be interesting to see what happens if Lowe's does do very, very well. Will we suddenly see a huge jump to speed ups? Or if everyone will kind of stick with the Calix now that they've forked out all the money for them?
Oh, I fully expect that. As soon as somebody goes fast on something, there'll be half the teams or half the riders telling their teams, I need that to go faster.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So now we'll move on to the next part, which is Moto3. Will Estrella Galicia and their riders dominate the races? Will the pressure of being called the Marquez Slayer crack the young Fabio Quartararo? Can Fanardi and Bastianini qualify better and be a championship contenders all year? How will Maria Herrera perform with the Calvo team. What's next, Vasquez? So first things first, I think that Fabio will not crack under pressure and that the Estrella Galicia team will be pretty much as dominant as they were last year in Moto3. I think that Fabio is going to take all of this in his stride. You know, obviously for Moto3 testing, rules are somewhat relaxed in terms of what you can and can't have on the bike. So maybe some of his testing times were a bit better than you'd expect. But no, I think that Fabio is going to be pretty scary in Moto3.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't think Fabio, and I don't think many of the young kids are spending a lot of time, you know, reading the internet sites, going through the forums, and seeing what people think of them. I think these kids are, you know, kind of living in a bubble, kind of just focused on their world. And you know, if somebody's making them up to be the second coming, I don't think they're really thinking about that. They're very focused on what they're doing. So yeah, I expect him to be as scary as we all think.
Yeah, which is probably not good for the likes of Fanardi and Bastianini. Neither of them had super amazing tests. I mean, obviously it's testing, so you know, who really cares at the end of the day? But both Fanardi and Bastianini certainly can battle through the field, but as is pointed out, they really do need to qualify better so that they don't have to waste so much tire getting through the field.
Yeah, the second part of the question on how Maria Herrera will do. I expect her to do pretty well, but then again, it's her first time in the World Championship or first full season in the World Championship. I do kind of expect her to do better than Ana Carrasco. She seems to have had, you know, better form starting out and was doing better even in the CEV than Ana ever did.
Yeah.
But again, you know, first full season in the World Championship, you know, if she's finishing mid-pack, that's going to be, you know, a fantastic finish for her.
Yeah, certainly, for sure. And then as for Vasquez, I don't know. Vasquez, he obviously had a crash in testing, quite badly hurt his ankle. I didn't expect Vasquez to be as fast as he was last year, so definitely coming into this year, Vasquez has more expectations, at least in my eyes, of what he should, I guess, be doing on that bike. But it'll be hard to see. With Moto3, it does get a bit crazy. Vasquez is maybe the craziest of the crazies, which is in theory good, I think, especially in Moto3. But we'll have to wait and see for Vasquez. He, much like Alexis Masbou, his fellow elder statesman of the class, are quite unpredictable and blow a bit hot and cold.
Yeah, I expect Efren to be trying really hard. You know, and hopefully he can stay focused on this year's job and isn't thinking too much about, you know, what comes next, because obviously it's not going to be Moto3. But he's a trier. He'll be there. If Moto3 riders are terriers, Efren Vázquez is a Jack Russell. He will try and try and try and never stop.
Yep. Unfortunately, that has ended in once or twice in the gravel trap for him.
Oh, yeah, for him and for others.
Yeah, so moving on to Moto2, hope for close racing within the top 10. I know it's only testing, but crashes from Rabat are a bit eye-opening. I'll be keeping an eye on the Moto3 graduates, Alex Marquez, Alex Rins. I think Rins is carrying a massive chip on his shoulder and will be a top 10 finisher. So yeah, certainly, I think that the top 10 racing in Moto2 will continue to be pretty close. It's whether someone can kind of catch Tito Rabat in my eyes and make it so that the battle for first is as close as the battle for, you know, fifth through tenth.
Yeah, I think you're right. And as far as do we read anything into Tito's crashes during testing, I could be wrong, but I read absolutely nothing into them. I think that's just Tito trying hard and finding the edge.
Yeah, exactly. The best place to do things like that is in testing, where, you know, if the worst does happen and you do get injured, you at least have some time to recover. Whereas, you know, if you are trying to find that limit to that extent in practice, you know, you only have 1 or 2 days to recover from whatever injury you might sustain. So best to push it to the limit in testing. Then moving on to MotoGP. This is broken down into teams. So we'll just go through this one by one, starting with Repsol Honda. Can Danny Pedrosa find some grit and aggression to battle the top riders, or is he just keeping Scott Redding's bike warm for him? Can Marquez win three on the bounce? Can anyone catch the Hondas?
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting comments there. As far as keeping Scott's bike warm for him.
Yeah, that's maybe the one that a bit ambitious.
Yeah, I think Scott's got some earning of the bike to do still.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly one or two other riders that Repsol Honda are keeping an eye on, and that, yeah, Redding will have to work very hard if he does want that bike.
Yeah, because he's got, you know, Miller is also in a similar situation, you know, albeit on his first year and an open bike. But I'd say Miller is the, you know, where Honda have put their focus.
Yeah, certainly. If I had to pick a rider out of Miller and Scott to get that Repsol bike, I'd probably go with Miller just because Honda have put a lot of faith in Miller. I mean, I'm sure Honda have faith in Redding. Obviously, they've given him a factory bike, but it seems like Honda investing a bit more in Miller.
And as far as Danny, does he have the grit and determination to do it? You know, I don't know. I don't know if Danny is really going to do anything except, and this is a terrible thing to say, but is he the Momola of the 21st century? Mm. I kind of think he's going to be the guy that, you know, finishes second four times, and that's all he does.
Yeah, certainly it's foreseeable. I mean, finishing top three in MotoGP is still an incredible achievement, but yeah, I think that for me, last season was kind of the make it or break it season for Danny ever winning a title, and unfortunately he didn't quite manage it, and I think that Marquez can probably win three on the bounce. I think it's going to be a pretty tall order for Rossi, Pedrosa, and Lorenzo, and maybe the Ducatis to challenge Mark to stop the three in a row.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, anything could happen still.
Mm, certainly.
But I think, you know, I certainly think that Mark's got everything that it takes to win the championship. And as far as second, you know, if you throw Danny, Valentino, and Jorge into that last lap together, I can't see anything happening but Danny losing out. You know, the other guys get their elbows out, and Danny's going to get shuffled back.
Yeah, I think, from casual observation, it seems like Rossi and Lorenzo are much more fired up than Danny Pedrosa is going into this season. But maybe I'm just looking at specific sources and not at others. I don't know. But moving on to Yamaha and the movie star team, Rossi's laying the mind games on again. Rossi's quote from the other week, Yamaha doesn't make a lot of new parts, but when they do, you know it will be better. A clear dig at Honda Marquez for their three different factory bikes at Sepang 1. Can Jorge find some grit of his own and ride in the rain, mix conditions without falling down the order? If not, Rossi will outshine him again this year. I don't know if Rossi was making a direct dig at Honda with that comment. I guess it could be interpreted that way. I also don't think that Honda coming with three different factory bikes for Marquez at Sepang 1 was a bad thing. I think that that shows that, you know, Honda have a lot of resources to play with, certainly.
Yeah, and I think as much as anything else, it's just different, you know, different design philosophies.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, Honda are ready to come to the track with, you know, a lot of different things. Maybe they have two very different riders and just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, and maybe Yamaha do a bit more of their work back in the workshop. Mm. You know, if that's what Rossi meant when he talked about, you know, the number of new parts, maybe it's true, but I certainly didn't get that from it.
No, and I mean it's not beyond Rossi to play mind games, so it could very well have been. As for Jorge, I think that he'll be much more determined this year. He's by all accounts he's already thinner, already fitter than he was last year. Can he overcome that mental barrier that we saw a couple of times in the rain? I think so. I think Jorge is very strong. You remember in his rookie season, he broke both his ankles multiple times and still managed to, you know, get on. I'll always remember that China race when he'd literally just broken both his ankles and his bike stalled on the line, so he had to push start it with broken ankles. That shows a lot of mental fortitude, to me at least.
Yeah, I think he has the capacity to push past the pain, you know, like many of them do. But I think if you looked at the top four riders, you know, the two Honda Repsols, the two Movistar Yamahas, I think Jorge might be the most mentally fragile, the most susceptible to, you know, falling into a hole if things start going poorly.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen it before. We've seen him, you know, get off to rocky starts. He's often very, very nervous on the grid, you know, asking about tires, asking about setup. And it seems like Ramon Forcada is more his psychologist than his crew chief, just, you know, trying to calm him down and get him to focus on the start of the race. But like you said earlier, I think he's in a good position. You know, he redid his training regimen. He seems to be in better shape early in the year. I think it's going to be down to, does he get off to a good start at Qatar? And does he not get off to too good a start at Austin?
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully we don't have a repeat of that very interesting start from Jorge last year.
Yeah, or hopefully we do, because that was really good.
Yeah, that it was pretty impressive. Yeah, I'm not sure Jorge liked that. I'm sure that if anyone made a comment in the paddock to Jorge about that when we do get to Austin, that they'd quickly have their paddock access revoked.
Yeah.
So moving on to Ducati. Bike has a long way to come, and both riders are capable of top five finishes. I want to see them battle on equal footing with the other factory teams, but I will say today that Iannone will end the season ahead of Dovi. I don't know about Iannone ending the season ahead of Dovi. Andrea Dovizioso is an incredibly good rider. He's, you know, he's not an alien, but he's by far best of the rest. And I think that Dovi can finish much more consistently than Iannone. And that, sure, Iannone will probably win a race before Dovi, but I think that the consistency will have Dovi ahead in the standings of Iannone.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think if you look at the best finish, it might favor the tall Andrea. But I think the more quiet Andrea will do better. He'll finish more often, and the other one will be in the gravel more often.
Yeah, and also the thing with Ducati being on equal footing with Honda and Yamaha, it's all very well that they're on equal footing bike-wise, you know? You put them on the exact same bike, they still have to beat the other riders. And I think that beating Marquez, beating Rossi, and beating Lorenzo, even with equal bikes, is going to be a very tall order for both Andreas.
Yeah, definitely. The thing I'm looking forward to the most with the Ducatis, especially the factory Ducatis, I can't wait till they get either a win or sufficient podiums to get on the same fuel and the same tires and, you know, get them up there again where factory bikes belong. That's what I'm looking forward to the most.
Yeah, certainly. And I don't know, we'll talk about testing next week, but from testing, it does look like there's certainly at least hope for Ducati. It does seem like the GP15 has kind of started to make some of the changes that needed to be made, and that hopefully we'll have them get rid of those open factory concessions soon.
We hope.
Exactly. So now moving on to Suzuki, the second last of the teams. Vinales is my new favourite rider. I was there when he took his win in Austin. Both riders seem extremely happy with the bike, and scoring points doesn't seem out of the reach for these guys. Espargaro's experience will help him early, but I think Vinales will find form as the season progresses. Yeah, I agree. I think that Suzuki will probably pretty regularly be in the points, maybe even fighting for that top 10 this season. And yeah, I certainly think that Espargaro will start and probably finish the season stronger than Vinales. But Vinales will make massive improvements as the season goes on. Vinales has already made massive improvements through testing.
Yeah, like you said, and I expect to see the Suzukis a little better than just in the points. You know, I expect them to be, you know, pushing the top 10 because they've showed good form. I think, like you said, Aleix will definitely be up there because he's, if nothing else, he's a trier. He will push and push,
getting
everything out of the bike. I don't want to say it the wrong way. It's not that I feel sorry for Vinales. I don't think he's ended up in a terrible place, but I can't help but think back to Chris Vermeulen. When Chris Vermeulen won World Supersport and then ended up on the Suzuki and just did nothing. I really hope that doesn't happen to Maverick, because I think Maverick is a real star. I think he's got incredible potential. I think we haven't even seen the best of him yet. And he's on a bike that I think the only thing that he can hope of his time at Suzuki is that somebody notices him from either Honda or Yamaha and says, we want this kid.
Yes. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, that is the thing with getting involved in a straight in a factory team like Suzuki, is that you're not in an LCR Honda or a Tech 3 where there's kind of a pretty clear path up to one of the, you know, the factory bikes. Yeah, he does have that perhaps chance of unfortunately getting stuck in, you know, maybe a subpar bike. I mean, I hope that the Suzuki is able to return to, you know, its 90s prowess and, you know, be able to fight for a title. But I think that's going to take a couple of years, and that, yeah, I don't know if we'll ever see Maverick Vinales on a Repsol Honda. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So finally, on to LCR Honda, specifically Jack Miller. He likes the young goon rider and he's shown improvement every time he swings the leg over the bike. And then there's Cal Crutchlow. Not the biggest fan of Cal Crutchlow, especially his Ducati time. The complaining and the I deserve more attitude. If the Honda doesn't work for him, he'll be the second coming of Biaggi in my eyes. Some strong words about Cal there.
Interesting.
I think that the Miller story will be interesting to follow. I think that Vinales will beat Miller almost every time out. you know, obviously having a factory bike or an open factory bike, whatever we want to call it, versus an open Honda does give Vinales that advantage. But certainly this year, I think that Vinales will pretty handily lead Miller to Rookie of the Year. As for Cal Crutchlow, I think that, sure, Cal maybe does complain a bit more than most, but a lot of riders complain. But I'm not sure if it's complaining to the riders. You know, riders are trying to get the best out of the bike that they can, the best out of the tyres, the best out of the suspension. So they do always kind of want more, and they always, like, they focus on the problems with the bike because that's what they go back to the crew chief and, you know, they say, you know, I can't feel the front, whatever.
Yeah, I think all, you know, if you look across sport, I think all top-level sportsmen, they live in the belief, and sometimes it's delusion, sometimes it's confidence, that they're better than anybody else, and given the right conditions and when there's equipment in play, you know, like in motorcycle racing, they've got the right equipment, that they can win. You know, they all think that. They've all got that belief, and that's what allows them to do what they do. You know, if not, they'd be floundering in the back. You know, look at Marco Melandri. He doesn't believe in himself, evidently. Yep.
We'll get to that in a second.
And he's suffering from it. So I don't think Cal is saying anything different than what every motorcycle racer thinks. I think the only difference is Cal says it.
Yeah.
And to the to the ear that's not used to hearing that, it sounds like, you know, whining and complaining and whinging and all of that. But I think all it is an incredibly, you know, self-assured person, you know, pointing to where they think the problem is. And I would bet that Rossi and Danny and Mark and all of these guys, you know, in the confines of their huddle are saying the same things.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of years ago, back when the Honda wasn't super great before Stoner joined Repsol, you know, Danny was almost always, air quotes, complaining about the Honda, you know, this, that, and the other's wrong. You know, he'd always look depressed and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I think that, I don't know, maybe it's Cal's media training or lack thereof, perhaps. But, I think that saying complaining is maybe a bit harsh, but certainly that this is kind of a make or break year for Cal. I'm not sure if the Honda doesn't go well for Cal, I'm not sure he has too many other options in the GP paddock, at least. He's kind of ridden everything now.
That could be true, yeah.
Yes, thank you for that email, Jarrett Bean. Once again, if you want to send your emails and have them read out on the show, motopod@motopodcast.com. So now moving on to just a brief bit of news before we talk about the World Superbike race. So as people will have probably noticed, Troy Bayliss rode at Phillip Island.
Who's that?
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently some really old guy who used to win races every once in a while.
Hey, he's not so old. He's quite a young man.
Sorry. Well, I have to get you and Dave back for the cyberbullying that went on last episode. But anyway, so Troy Bayliss is apparently in the frame alongside Michele Pirro to continue to replace Davide Giuliano for the foreseeable rounds that Davide's out. Bayliss posted an update to social media about hoping his training wasn't for nothing. You know, this could just be Bayliss trying to stir things, or it could be that he's actually going to come back for a couple more races. We'll get to Bayliss's performance at Phillip Island in a second, but personally, I think that it'd probably be a bit better for Pirro to have that bike. Pirro's been a pretty loyal test rider to Ducati, and I think that some World Superbike races would be a pretty good reward for Pirro. Although I'm not sure how much he's ridden the Panigale. I think he's been pretty focused on the GP bikes.
Yeah, again, and whether Bayliss is just stirring things up, I don't think Bayliss operates on that level of subterfuge and mental game. I think he
not
just
on the Cal Crutchlow social media level.
I think he operates on a very direct, you know, I want to ride and I want to get out there and race and I still think I can do it level.
Mm. And I mean, with more testing, he could certainly be fighting for the top 10, but
he was almost there.
Yeah, he was. So just one bit of testing news that we will touch on before next week is Marco Melandri his spiral downward has unfortunately continued quite rapidly. Melandri, for some of the test, was on a hybrid CRT MotoGP Aprilia Superbike to try and help him learn the Bridgestone tyres. And he continued to be bottom of the timesheets by quite a margin. I think he was 5 seconds off the pace of Marquez and about 2 seconds off the pace of teammate Bautista. This led him to tweeting perhaps the most depressing tweet I've ever seen from a motorcycle racer, saying that he simply couldn't ride and he was sorry to all the guys. The guys obviously being the people in his team. So I'm not sure we'll see Melandri lining up at Qatar. That's just my personal feeling. As we kind of touched on before, a rider who isn't confident and who doesn't believe in himself is not only a slow rider, but potentially a dangerous rider to other people on track.
Yeah, you know, and what the thing that surprises me the most about this entire situation is that people are surprised. Mm. You know, and again, I don't think Melandri's a bad rider. I don't think that he's, any sort of a bad character. I think the behavior that he's exhibiting is really what we've seen from him before, you know, and he's a confidence rider.
Mm,
if he doesn't have that confidence, and that's whether it's the Ducati, whether it's that old Kawasaki, you know, whatever bike he's on, if it's not giving him the feel that, you know, that he's comfortable with, that he needs, he's kind of nowhere. You know, he's very, very hot and cold. It seems like a bit mentally fragile. That's not really fair because I don't know the guy.
Yeah.
But it seems like his performance is definitely very, very sensitive to the feeling that he's got with the bike. You know, it's more so than some guys. Some guys seem to be able to ride through problems, and some guys seem to be able to, you know, to only excel when everything's in its place. I just hope they find a way to make him comfortable, because it's a bit painful. You know, it was really great to see him run up front in World Superbike last year.
Yeah, and he added a lot of excitement to those races, you know, maybe through one or two hard passes. But
yeah, he was a bit of a loose cannon sometimes, but he was always exciting. And, you know, one of the lasting memories that I have of motorcycle racing in general is Melandri coming out of the last corner at PI on that red Honda, you know, one hand in the air, one hand gassing it, and the bike sideways. You know, I will never forget that. And I just, you know, I hope he can find a little bit of that again.
Yeah, but it's just, I just don't know how he and Aprilia can refine that confidence between now and Qatar, because, you know, I think it's a vicious cycle of he has no confidence, so he's going to have no confidence in the Qatar race. He's going to have a bad result there, so he's not going to be motivated for the next race. And then I think it's just going to be kind of a continuing spiral of Melandri just having no confidence and not really wanting to push.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? It seems to be centered on the Bridgestone tires, that, you know, because obviously he's coming from a very different tire. You know, the Pirellis, it's different. You know, I've only ever ridden, you know, Pirellis and Dunlops, and I know that they're not the same, but, you know, even there's a difference in the front construction. One's very stiff, one's very soft. So I imagine that there's some of that he's facing, you know, a very different front feel that he's dealing with. I wonder, I'd be really interested to hear what he, you know, did he even ride on the Michelins, what he thinks of the Michelins? Does that give him any hope going into the next year? Is he just figuring, well, it's terrible now, but I just need to get through it and I can get to a place where I've got some feel? I I'd love to hear some of that. I know we're not going to, because nobody can talk about the tire testing, but, you know, maybe there's something there for him. Who knows?
Yeah, hopefully there is a bit of hope. You know, there had been kind of this rumor that he and Torres would switch. However, the official World Superbike Twitter account tweeted a photo of Torres with two thumbs up saying, "I'm here to stay." So Torres definitely won't be replacing Melandri if Melandri does get replaced. Personally, I think it could be Michael Laverty, the Aprilia test rider, who does replace Melandri if Melandri has had enough. But it's one of those things where we'll just have to wait and see. You know, there's a lot unknown. Obviously, people in Aprilia and people close to Melandri know better what's going on with Melandri's head. They do, as you say, know about, you know, did he refine confidence with the Michelins? Can he trudge through a year of pretty bad results to potentially come back stronger? We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it'll be a long year of waiting and seeing for him.
Yep. So now moving on to the first race of the season. Racing was back. Although for much of the weekend, it didn't really seem like there was a race. It seemed like it was a private Troy Bayliss track day, judging by some of the updates that we were getting through on the various social media channels. But World Superbike back, I'd say almost better than ever. The weekend was pretty exciting across all three races. We obviously didn't have the stock bikes there, so we still haven't seen the new R1 out on track yet. But yeah, it was a good weekend overall, I thought.
Yeah, it was a great weekend. It was, and I think some really interesting things to pull out of the results. I think, you know, before we go reading down the results, just the highlights for me, the guys that finished up front, you know, Ray and Haslam and Ray in the different races.
Mm.
I think it showed, you know, take them off a bike that wasn't, you know, really up to spec, and put them on the top bikes from last year, and what do you know? There they are running right up front.
Yeah. Speaking of that, my kind of rider of the meeting, as we'll get to, was Michael Vandermark, who put in two incredible rides on that Honda that Raya and Haslam struggled so much with. In race two, it didn't end so well for him, but he was up there. He was leading at one point, as we'll get to. So I think that Michael Vandermarquez gets my rider of the meeting.
Vandermarquez, very nice.
Thanks.
Yeah, it was impressive. It was impressive seeing him run up front and then doing very well in the second race, you know, until it didn't go so well.
Mm.
But very impressive. On the other hand, you know, Sylvain Gintily on that Honda, not doing terribly, you know, salvaging decent results. And I kind of wonder how much of that is the bike, how much of that is him being still a bit sore from a very big get-off at Jerez.
Yeah, he had another crash at Phillip Island as well, one during testing and one during practice. So
right.
Probably a bit stiff.
So probably feeling it. And seventh and fifth, you know, as he finished, is pretty close to where those bikes, you know, have been doing last year. So it's, you know, not terrible for the bike, but we were all expecting a bit more from Sylvain. We just don't quite know why it is yet.
Mm. We also had an incredibly lucky escape for a David Salom, who had a really nasty crash coming out of the last corner. High-sided, completely cartwheeled, unfortunately on his head, through the gravel trap. But luckily, thanks to, you know, the excellent protection that motorcycle racers now have, he escaped with just a concussion and a broken third finger. But, you know, if you see that crash, you certainly think that it's going to be a lot worse than just a broken third finger, that's for sure.
Yeah, very lucky boy. I remember as I was watching it, I was fearing the worst.
Yeah, certainly.
And luckily he got away with it.
Yeah, that's one of the few times that I've kind of had to look away from a replay just because I didn't want to see it again. That was, yeah, definitely one of the biggest crashes I've seen for a long, long time.
Yeah, and getting back just to an overview of the results, one of the things that struck me the most about, you know, the result, and it's probably a bit World Superbike, a bit World Supersport, you know, we'll get onto the rest of it later, is how well a few of the ex-Moto2 riders that were doing pretty terribly last year are doing both in World Superbike and in World Supersport. You know, in World Superbike, the, you know, ex-teammates, Nico Terol and Jordi Torres, guys that were kind of nowhere last year.
Yeah,
you know,
they'd struggling had some for better, points.
Yeah, they'd had some better results the year before, but last year, really, really dire. And the pair of them, I think, doing better than anybody, you know, would have expected. Yeah, and with Torres being the real star.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, Torres was a close second for my rider of the meeting from Vandermarquez. But yeah, both of them doing really, really well. Both of them in the top 10, both races, well, apart from Torres, who crashed out the second race. But yeah, we'll come back to the whole Moto2 refugees doing well. I got some stats for us on that one.
Very good.
So we can have a bit of an in-depth conversation on that one after we go over World Supersport. But first, we'll talk about race one. Race one, as we mentioned, was won by Jonathan Rea from Leon Haslam and Chaz Davies. They were pretty clearly the front runners in that race. At the start of the race, you had Vandermark and Torres up with them a bit. Vandermark pushed Tom Sykes wide at turn one on, I think it was lap five or so. This caused Tom Sykes to be very, very upset. Tom Sykes does not like it when people are a bit rough with him, unfortunately. And then maybe the biggest thing of race one was we had Troy Bayliss back with his very distinct style. He certainly hasn't lost the Baylistic upright style. It was very interesting to see him, you know, lapping with all these riders, you know, trying to get their elbows down. And Bayliss is still destroying Alpenstar boots by dragging his toe. And just, I think it was in race one that he had his toe slider flapping off about halfway through the race.
Yeah, so, classic Bayliss, you know, 90s superbike style.
Yeah, it was pretty cool to watch, just the contrast in styles, certainly.
And the other interesting thing was watching the just how his bike reacted in the setup. I mean, nobody rides as loose as Troy Bayliss. His bike was just jumping around, even on the straights. Just amazing. You know, you were expecting the worst at any moment.
Yeah. That's definitely something I noticed as well. You know, even coming onto the straights, they have huge wobbles, you know, midway through the straight, the bike's twitching around and all sorts of things. Definitely, yeah, as you say, much looser, much more aggressive maybe than some of the other riders. Yeah, compared to Chaz Davies, you know, his Ducati was pretty smooth. I mean, the Ducati seems a little more jumpy than maybe the Kawasaki, but yeah, Bayliss had certainly, maybe he was using Davide's settings. Bayliss would eventually finish 13th, which, you know, he hasn't tested that bike for 2 years. He hasn't raced since 2008. He hasn't done any testing. I'd say that a 13th is a pretty stellar result. There'll probably be some full-time World Superbike riders who struggle to have their best finish of the season be 13th.
Yeah, I think the same. I was hoping for top 10. It would have been nice to happen, but I didn't really think, you know, my head didn't think that was going to happen.
Yeah, certainly would have been cool to see him win, but I think that was pretty unrealistic,
yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, that was never going to happen. That would take a lot of stars aligning.
Yeah, and 13th is more or less what I thought Bayless would be capable of. With more testing, maybe he could have really pushed into that top 10, but 13th is a very respectable result.
And I think there's a few guys behind him that have to start asking themselves some difficult questions.
Yep, certainly. One of those riders was Randy Depugnier. He was 17th in race one. He had quite a nasty crash, and there was quite a nasty photo going around on Twitter of his rear end, which was pretty much just purple, as he had a massive bruise there. I think he also cracked his tailbone, so he was complaining about having to sleep on his front. Not good for Depugnier, but I guess if you can say one thing about Depugnier, it's that he is used to some big crashes.
Yeah, he's a tough guy. He's practiced crashing a lot, that's for sure.
Top three, as we said, Raya Haslam Davies, Torres in fourth, Vandermark fifth. Excellent race from both Torres and Vandermark. They each had a turn, you know, fighting for the top three. It looked like at some points that they might be able to get the podium, but unfortunately, they just didn't quite have that. But, you know, top five in their first ever World Superbike races, I think that's an incredible result for both of them. Ahead of Tom Sykes in sixth, Gintoli seventh, Tyrol eighth. As we said, really good result from Tyrol. Better than I expected Tyrol would do, certainly. I think that by the end of the season, we'll probably see Tyrol up with Torres and Vandermark in the top five fighting for those podiums.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's probably, and it's good for him to, you know, I think start finishing that well this early, you know, bring back a little bit of the confidence that he probably didn't have last year. Mm. So like you said, I think we can expect to see more from him.
Yep. Alex Lowe's in ninth. He had bike problems throughout most of the weekend after some pretty heavy crashes, unfortunately. So he wasn't able to translate his testing pace into race pace. And he was definitely dejected after both races.
Yeah, the Suzuki guys just didn't have a good weekend. You know, I think they were expecting more after last year's results. Mm. And for whatever reason, it just didn't happen for them.
Yep, certainly. So then moving on to race two. Race two was actually pretty similar to race one. You had Raya and Haslam swap round. So the second race was won by Haslam from Jonathan Raya. Chaz Davies, again third. You know, it was an excellent weekend for all three of those riders. Pretty much any one of the three could have won either of the races. Race two came down to an incredibly close drag to the line between Raya and Haslam. Haslam just managed to get the slipstream that he couldn't quite manage in race one to pip Raya to the line by 0.01 of a second.
Yeah, it was a very, very hectic last lap. I have to say, by the time they were getting toward Lucky Heights, I was just hoping that they all finished.
Yeah.
It was really looking like somebody was going to push so hard that it was going to end in tears.
Yeah, especially with Haslam. Haslam was taking really quite different lines to Jonathan Raya, certainly. Haslam was taking much more sweeping lines, whereas it seemed like Raya was trying to keep it much tighter. Something that I also did notice in race two, before he crashed out, unfortunately, was that Michael Vandermark's corner speed is absolutely massive compared to everyone else's. Vandermark is able to make up so much through the corner. You know, maybe the Aprilia has a lot more power out of the corner, but Vandermark can certainly push that bike through the corner and carry a lot of corner speed. And I think that if he were to ever go to GP, that high corner speed riding style will help hugely.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing there is an ex-World Supersport rider. Mm. You know, bikes that don't have any power, that need to use more sweeping turns, that, you know, need to rely on mid-corner speed. I think we'll probably see him modify that sometime during the year. He'll figure out at some point.
Yeah, keep tweaking it.
Yeah, that the more powerful the bike is, the more V-shaped the corner becomes.
Mm. Vandermark crashed out, as did Torres. Troy Bayliss came into the pits and changed tyres. There weren't too many tyre problems overall in World Superbike. Phillip Island's obviously a pretty tricky track for the tyre guys. Whether Bayliss came in to practice pit stops or whether he came in because he did need new tyres, I didn't see anything that said that 100% either way. We certainly had some tyre problems in World Supersport, some pretty bad tearing there, but for the most part, it seems like the Pirellis stuck together.
Yeah, I think the whole tyre swap thing was Troy's way of saying, I'm fast. I think he just wanted to get out there again. He wanted to, you know, match times with the front guys, and just so that nobody had any questions about, was it a problem with the bike? Was it a problem with him?
Well, yeah, Troy's best lap was a 132.117, and your race winner, Leon Haslam, his best lap was a 131.889. So, you know, that's not too bad for Bayless to be 0.3 off the fastest lap of the race winner. Pretty good. Life in the old dog yet.
Definitely, definitely. And again, I hope I know that he wants to do another race. Who deserves it more and all that, I'm not really sure. But I think in terms of a spectacle and getting eyes on the sport, I hope he gets to ride again.
Yeah, that's certainly one thing that Bayless did do. There was a huge amount of content produced specifically for Bayless, as I said before. At the start of the weekend, it did seem a bit like a Troy Bayless track day, where it was kind of, what's Troy up to? But once it started racing, it was definitely focused on the front runners, and they were two excellent races. They were certainly some of the most exciting World Superbike races I've seen for a little bit, and hopefully we can continue that. Obviously, next round it's off to Thailand, new track, you know, who will learn it better? Which bike will go better? It seems like it'll probably be a pretty good Aprilia track. It seems like there's a pretty long straight there. But we'll have to wait and see. And then onto the standings, we have Rea and Haslam tied on 45 points, leading the championship together. Chaz Davies third with 32, Sykes fourth with 23, Gintoli fifth with 20, then Tirol, Camier, Torres, Bayoko, Vandermark, Depunier, Mercado, Lowe's, Ramos, and Sylvain Barrier, rounding out the top 15. Also, just quickly, big effort to Larry Pegram, who managed to score 2 points on the EBR with its new dual conventional brakes. So big ups to Larry Pegram, who got some points for EBR pretty early in the season. They struggled for points almost all of last season, so hopefully we can see them nipping one or two points a bit more consistently now.
Yeah, certainly. You know, not up at the sharp end yet, but, you know, a whole lot better than they were doing last year. So it shows some promise.
Yeah, massively. So now moving on to World Supersport, where things will get a bit interesting. The race was pretty much dominated by Jules Cluzel, 3.5 seconds at the finish line ahead of teammate Lorenzo Zanetti. But then the battle for third is what was really exciting. It was between Gina Rea, Carl Smith, and Rathpot Willerot. Willerot dropped off a bit towards the end, but the battle between Rea and Smith was incredibly intense. Kyle Smith has a very sideways riding style on that CBR 600. You know, even more so than a Moto 2 riding style. I think it was into turn 4. At one point, he got it maybe a bit too sideways and almost skidded a couple of people, but it was very impressive to watch.
Yeah, it was good to see, but a bit scary. I'm with you there. I thought a couple of times, you know, by the time he got it turning again, that it was going to be too late and he was going to take somebody out, but it all worked out in the end.
Yep, certainly. It was an unfortunate race for Keenan Sofoglu. He got pushed off at turn one in one of the opening laps by Kyle Smith, unfortunately. So Sofoglu managed to fight back to sixth, but that was a pretty hard fight for him. We did have some pretty bad tyre tearing from guys like Jacobson on the Kawasaki, who finished 10th. Tyres still an issue at Phillip Island. Cluzel and Zanetti, the MV seemed to be pretty okay to tyres, so maybe that helped them a bit as well. There were certainly a lot of comments of, it'll be the smartest rider, not the fastest rider, who wins the races at Phillip Island due to the tyres.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. Well, I mean, it could have been that, but definitely, you know, I think the MVs were a class above the other bikes. Very, very fast, both, you know, in a straight line and in the, you know, the more curvy sections. I think that... I don't know what it was with the tires, bad batches or just different bikes using the tires in different ways. Like you said, I saw a bunch of pictures with more than just tearing. I mean, it really looked like the tires were about to come apart, you know, really, really scary performance from the tires.
Yeah. Normally you see, you know, maybe one photo from a race about someone who did get a dud tire, but there were certainly at least five of them and from different bike makes as well. So it's not like it was just, you know, the Kawasaki's eating up tires in the Supersport race.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier an analysis of the Moto2 refugees. I guess we'll get to that. But here again is another example. Two guys, you know, Gino Rea and Rathpart Willerot, guys who were pretty much nowhere last year in Moto2. You know, in the English-speaking world, we probably had a little more connection to Gino, so we were aware of where he was. But were it not for that, he would be invisible. You know, he was really, really struggling, having a tough time. And get him, you know, get him back in the World Supersport paddock and bang, you know, up to number three.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, and I guess we'll go into my little analysis now. So of the top eight World Supersport riders, Jules Cluzel, Lorenzo Zanetti, Gina Rea, Kyle Smith, Rathaport Willerot, Kenyon Seforoglu, Baldellini, and Rolfo, all of those eight, except for Zanetti, have at some point raced in Moto2. So Jules Cluzel was third at Qatar in the 2010 Moto2 race, and then won in Silverstone that same year. Otherwise, he was pretty mid-pack in Moto2. Gina Rea was second at a wet Sepang after Ant West got disqualified for doping in 2012. Otherwise, Gino struggled to finish in the top 20. Kyle Smith struggled to score points when he was in Moto2, got kicked off the Aventia team for not scoring any points, basically. Rathaport Willerot, best finisher fourth in Moto2, otherwise averaging between 17th and 20th. Kenyon Seforoglu, second in Assen in 2011 in Moto2, had a lot of strong starts before fading as he'd overcooked the tyres a lot, especially in those two races at the end of 2010 when he replaced Tomizawa. Baldellini was second in Portugal 2010, otherwise mid-pack. Robbie Rolfo, third in Germany 2010, won in Sepang that same year, otherwise pretty mixed results, again struggling to get into the points. So we see all these guys who, you know, they've had one or two pretty good results, you know, one or two podiums, but otherwise they've struggled to score points, but now they come into World Supersport and they're pretty much dominating.
So the tough question is World Supersport really, you know, that much, well, less deep in terms of talent and just overall competition than Moto2? I mean, it's harsh to say, but it seems like that.
Well, I think certainly this demonstrates, you know, how much talent and how much of a fight it is in Moto2. You know, you can either interpret it, I guess, as taking away from World Supersport or really adding to Moto2. Maybe the really adding to Moto2 is the slightly more positive spin to put on it. But yeah, it is pretty incredible. And, I guess there's also the issue of, you know, guys like Cluzel, guys like Rea, guys like Smith maybe didn't have the best bike in Moto2, didn't have the best teams, but now they're in, you know, air quotes, factory teams. So, you know, obviously that adds to it. So it's kind of difficult to fully pass all the information, I guess.
Yeah, it's tough. There, like you said, there are a lot of variables. But then, you know, focusing on, you know, probably the person I was the most focused on during this race, Gina Rea. Just thinking, you know, again, you know, having such a tough time previously, I expected him obviously to do better, you know, obviously to be in the points, and I thought top 10 would be a reasonable finish, you know, first time in a few years back on this bike. You
almost
know,
no testing.
Some experience on, you know, he had ridden this, you know, a few years ago, did pretty well. Like you said, no testing, but third, I think really surpassed what I expected from him.
Yeah. Much like you, I thought he'd be top 10, you know, top five would be a pretty good result, but I was pretty surprised by the podium. It was also interesting, just to get into leathers quickly. So Gino Rea is now sponsored by Held Leathers, but he was wearing a Dionysi suit, which he had conveniently placed some duct tape over the Dionysi logos and Dionysi shoulders, way to cover it up and replace the Held sponsorship. I'm not sure why he wasn't wearing his Held set of leathers. Maybe they didn't fit properly. I don't know.
We're going to have to find professional help for you for your little leather fetish.
Probably. I think it was Scott Jones who posted a photo of Tony Elias the other day. And immediately I realized that one of the gloves was a Dionysi, whereas the other was Alpenstars.
Yes.
So, I sat myself down in a corner for 5 minutes after that little event. But anyway, back on track. That was kind of the biggest thing that I took away from the World Supersport race, was that these guys who have struggled immensely in Moto2 are suddenly able to come and, you know, and dominate the series. And I think that is why we see guys like Romano Ramos and like Jesco Raffin, who do pretty well in Spanish Moto2, come to MotoGP Moto2 and just struggle, because everyone there is at the top of their game. And, you know, imagine if you put Tito Rabat in World Supersport. You know, sure, he'd have to adapt to the tyres, but if he can win a Moto2 race, you know, pretty handily, imagine what he could do in World Supersport.
Yeah, it's impressive to see what seems to be, you know, a real difference in level between the two championships.
Yeah, as we said, you know, there's the difference of bikes. You know, some bikes are a bit more factory than others, you know, riding style suiting. So it's obviously impossible to, you know, be 100% definite, but certainly there is something to be said about the differing the differing levels in World Supersport and in Moto2. And as you said, also, you know, you have guys like Tirol and Torres struggled in Moto2, but now they come into even World Superbike on bikes bigger than either of them have ever ridden, or ridden competitively at least. And they can, you know, be in the top 10 quite handily.
Yep, but I guess we'll probably have to wait for a few more data points during the year to make any conclusions.
Certainly. So yeah, that's definitely something that I'll be watching, is how these ex-Moto2 guys do go versus these kind of veterans of the classes. Certainly in World Superbike, there's a lot of veterans. World Supersports, maybe a bit fresher blood. Do you have anything else to add at all?
No, that's pretty much it. The only problem I have now is, and it happens to us every year, World Superbike comes along in February, gets us all excited. The season has started again. We're all ready to get some racing. And then it's wait for another month.
Yeah, that is kind of the bummer. It is a bit of a tease. I think it's when we're recording this, I think it's something like 29 days till MotoGP kicks off in Qatar, give or take. So yeah, there is a bit of a wait, unfortunately. That's kind of also why we've decided to do testing as the next show, is to spread out the content so we don't have one 4-hour episode. Hopefully we can get two decent sized episodes out of it. But yeah, certainly, it is a bit of a tease, isn't it?
It's winter all over again.
Exactly. So yeah, I think that's more or less it from us.
Yeah, well, thanks, Harry. Good to do a little bench racing with you again.
Yeah, got me excited for the rest of the season. Can't wait to get back to everyone being racing, to get back to the AMA, to the BSB, to the Superbikes, and to MotoGP, obviously, all being racing. I think it's going to be pretty hectic across all those classes, and you know, hopefully we'll be able to bring everyone a bit of something from each class.
Yeah, can't wait. Like we always say, best season yet.
And there's been a lot of people on Twitter stealing that. I think we might have to get a trademark out on that one.
Well, we'll just keep quiet till the end of the year, and then we'll remind them.
Yeah, exactly. One quick bit of news that I just remembered is Colin Edwards will be joining the Moto America team as a commentator. So if you've missed Colin Edwards, be sure to tune in to the Moto America races as he will be commentating them, and I'm sure that those will be pretty good commentaries. He'll be alongside Jonathan Green.
I think Jonathan Green, and there's another woman that does the commentary who I can't remember her name.
Yeah, I can't remember her name either. We'll look it up for next show. But yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to a Moto America, almost just for the commentary now.
Should be good, and I bet that the guy who administers the beep button for the expletives, he is going to have the hardest job of the year.
Yeah, definitely. That beep finger will be well-trained. That's all from us this week at Motopod. Thanks for joining me, Len.
You bet, Harry. Good to talk to you again.
Yep. We'll catch everyone next week for some testing, to talk about testing. And yeah, we'll catch everyone next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.